painting to photography, from beadwork to woodworking. KQAL-FM on the campus of Winona State University presents Artbeat. Artbeat highlights the work and accomplishments of local artists from in and around Winona. Support for Artbeat is made possible by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.
On today's Artbeat, Brianna Klaprig sits down with Minnesota artist Carl Unisch. Carl is a WSU graduate and received his master's degree in fine art at the University of Massachusetts, Dartmouth. Carl now lives in Pilot Mound, Minnesota, where he grew up, and also has his own art studio there. Here's Brianna Klaprig with Carl Unisch on today's Artbeat.
Hi, I'm Carl Unisch. I'm an artist, and I'm from Pilot Mound, Minnesota.
Okay. Could you tell us a bit about yourself and your work and what brought you to this career?
I've always been an artist. And the one thing that I like to say is I'm always a big A artist. It's my career. It's not a supplemental job. It's not a hobby. It's not a dalliance. That's what I do for a living. As a kid, you know, the typical things artistic, you know, I like to draw, I like to tinker, I like to take things apart. I was curious, but I didn't realize I wanted to be an artist until I knew I didn't want to be anything else, if that could be explained. I tried a lot of different jobs, tried a lot of different tastes of careers in my 20s. And even I had, you know, started out my time in undergrad thinking I was going to be criminal justice major. And after about half a semester, I was like, what am I doing? And decided, no, I'm going to be brave and I'm going to be an artist. I knew it the whole time. I just didn't openly admit it to myself. Changed my major. And from there, it's been full steam ahead. Went through undergrad, went to state, dilly-dallied around making art, building a studio in my later 20s. And then at 30 decided, okay, why don't I get a master's? Not to teach, but to just be a better artist, more well-rounded artist. And went out to the New England area, went to New Bedford, Massachusetts, went to University of Massachusetts at Dartmouth, and got my master's in sculpture. And I'm using all of that knowledge, plus whatever I'm curious in learning now, to continue being a big A career artist.
Do you want to touch on a little bit of the many different types of mediums you use and what you most like?
Primarily now, my bread and butter work is the stained glass work or the leaded glass work. A lot of commissions popping right now. Gallery picked me up in Minneapolis. Anita Sue Coleman Gallery picked me up. Lanesboro Art Center carries my work. And just got done with three different Percent for Art commissions recently. The last of the work you've seen in here being the tail end of that. Outside of that, a lot of cast iron, cast metal work, aluminum, iron, whatnot, installations. What carries over in all the work I'm doing, my sculptures and whatnot, there's this reclamation and touching on, you know, the hobbies that people obsess themselves with, whether it's stained glass, taxidermy, tatting, model making, dollhouse, ad infinitum. I mean, I could keep going on. Anything that has to do with hobby, I'm interested in, because the main reason I am interested in that is because it's a art obsession for an audience of oneself. Anybody that's an enthusiast about something, they do that for themselves. They don't do it for an empowered audience or a money-throwing audience. They do it for themselves because they're passionate about it. They believe in it that much. So I'm really interested in what kind of drive people have to do these. What you look at it and go, well, is it craft? Is it art? Is it both? Is it neither? And I look at these enthusiasms that people have that are creative, fully creative, and they're obsessive about it, like to the point of neurosis. It can get pretty chronic, and how much money they'll throw at their own creative career in a hobby. And I go, gosh, that's untapped resource for a lot of interest for me. So I'm a big pinball fan, and people that collect things, these collections people have, I'm really interested in what people collect for their own personal pleasure, whether it's, you can fill in the blank. People collect so many different things. And I take that knowledge, and I take that experience, and I take that curiosity, and I keep throwing it back into the work. So when I'm making the stained glass windows, I'm trying to grab things that people collect. Glassware, broken things that they can't stand to throw out. They're just obsessively hanging onto it. These hoarders that have the stuff they can't let go of because it somehow is precious to them. At the same time, it's junk, but at the same time, it's precious to this one audience member themselves. So it's this salvation, this reclamation, this hoarding, this intense chronic absorption of stuff and information that is keyed into the stuff that they collect.
I notice a lot of your works, they don't involve a subject, a person subject, per se, directly in representing a person, like mm-hmm. a figure.
Yep.
But with those objects, it sounds like you're showing them or different people in a different light with what they collect. And
mm-hmm. It's all like a degree and a half of separation. What kind of narrative can you create? Whether it's a disassociated narrative or a directly objective narrative, what kind of narrative are we creating, or what narrative am I creating by taking these, whether they're utilitarian or often they are, or pieces of utilitarian objects, and putting them together in this narrative and trying to create this story of that's either made up or it has some elements of truth to it that have actually happened, and create this narrative to gain some interest from the viewer going, what's that about? And people bring their own baggage to everything that they judge when they experience it. Understanding that when I create this narrative, I want to leave a few gaps there for someone like yourself to walk up and go, oh, this reminds me of X, and I remember this X reminds me of this time that I did fill in the blank. So then all of that, that's that exchange that you and I have as audience and art maker, where we create this little narrative together. Whether you know you're doing it or not, I create the physical concrete object, and you bring some of that baggage into play, some of your own continuum into play, and then we have a little dance there, conceptually.
Would you say that it's more of a dialogue between the viewer and the piece, as opposed to the piece just existing for exactly what it is?
Yeah, it's more of that, actually, yeah. Trying to well, there, that would gain resonance. I mean, if you walk away having some kind of experience with something, I think that's going to resonate with an audience member a lot more than just sitting there, oh, isn't that pretty? And then whistle out the door. See?
Okay. And have you worked in any other mediums? You're mostly kind of 3D. I would consider this 3D. I mean,
yeah.
Putting it together, it's definitely more than that. Were you ever interested in two-dimensional work?
I'm actually forcing myself. This is a disclosure now. I'm forcing myself to draw more now. I typically don't draw a lot, and I know that it would help me if I did that a lot more. Not that my drawing is bad, but there's something missing that I need to explore when this drawing is going to come back more into what I'm doing. How that's going to work, I don't know yet. And that's some of the excitement that's building up. If I can just draw just a little something every day, it becomes like an exercise. You know, every other day I go jog 2 miles. Well, how about every other day between my jogs, I draw for 2 hours or something, you know, just to have some kind of little more regimen that helps me become a better artist and I can discover new things that I can bring back into the work that I'm doing.
Have you ever had any, throughout your life, just defining moments as an artist? I know you said in college you realized that you couldn't do anything else. That was just it was the only thing you wanted to do. Is there any other time in your life that kind of reassured you again or before then?
Yeah, I almost got kicked out of my master's program.
And how did that work out?
I didn't get kicked out, but I decided to do a lateral shift. There was a chess game going on. Long story short is that I'm a person who's pretty intense. And when you take that intensity, that focused intensity, and you bring it to an established institution, that established institution, that's the key words, it's established and it's an institution, and that established institution has a set mode of how it likes to run. Well, as an artist, I firmly believe that you should question every rule out there to see what it is about that has weaknesses, not necessarily to add anarchy to it, but to find out more about yourself by testing your own boundaries. What's my comfort level? How can I step outside of that? But when you step outside of your comfort level and then you end up making other people uncomfortable, that's where you run the risk of possibly doing harm. Didn't do that. I know I can honestly say I didn't do that. However, I will say that when you test the boundaries of somebody else who likes their comfort level at ease, in an industry where comfort level really doesn't apply except as a barrier that you choose to step over or not, and I choose to step over that often. To be blatantly honest, I pissed a couple people off, and that was for the good, because at the time, I was also assisting a famous international artist, Mark Dian, in a lot of his work. And he was guiding me, and he actually gave me insight to this, and this was after the whole incident occurred. And I found out from him that he almost got kicked out of his master's program as well when he was going through that at Columbia University in New York. And it gave me a bit more resolve to say, yeah, I did the right thing. I stuck to my guns because I firmly believed in what I was doing, despite the opposition from on high.
So was it kind of your methodology or the fact that you were finding a niche that wasn't something that the institution necessarily
I was working
promoted?
With dead animals in an institution. I was bringing dead animals in and working with them. They didn't like that.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing was is that I'm looking at it going, taxidermists do that. A mortician has to do that. Forensic scientists have to do that. Why can't an artist? Damien Hirst has done it. Why not? And for them, it was, of course, health issues, safety issues. And I'm just like, listen, I'm an old hunter and fisherman from way back. I'm not going to do anything with this. That's going to hurt somebody else. You know, years of deer hunting and fishing, I know how to prepare food. I also know when organic materials going bad, get it out of there. But the thing is that there's a lot of sensitive people in the art world, and guess what? That makes them a lot more conservative than me.
Mm-hmm.
Which challenges the idea of artists being liberal as well, if you think about it.
Liberal in certain aspects.
See, exactly.
In chosen
exactly.
aspects, right.
Exactly. And I sat there and I went, you know what? I'm not going to be that conservative. I'm going to actually, you know, not force myself, but explore things that other people aren't interested in exploring. Because when you're in a metro area, a megalopolis that I was in between Boston and New York, the connections of the natural world, no matter what people say, how many connections they had, they really didn't have a lot of connections because comparatively, from my standpoint, that's how I grew up, is having full frontal connection with the natural world as a farm kid, as a hunter, as a fisherman, trapping gophers, doing all that, tilling the ground, weeding the garden, painting the barn, all of it. You're at the mercy of nature every day, and you're aware of it. And trying to explain that through your work, through a challenging media, such as the dead organic material that I was working with, the fauna and the flora, they had a hard time wrapping their heads around it. And I was glad, still in retrospect, I still stand by myself saying, you know what, I'm glad I did that. And I still do it to this day. You go to my website, you see all the dead animal sculptures, you know.
I think without that, some of your work, it wouldn't be the same, I guess. And do you think that experience just made you more sure of what you were doing? The fact that you were allowed to question that, or people questioned you, it made you more firm? And
It was reassuring because I look at it this way. The more questions you can raise in the work you're doing, but make them like intellectual questions rather than content questions, but intellectual questions. Really curious intellectual questions, which is what I was doing and still do, I think the better. I mean, that's the point of making this work is to ask questions. The answers will come to those who want the answers. That, to me, the answers, that's for everyone else to find out. I can find out my own too. But it's to question things. What if this? What if that? You know?
One of the professors yesterday had an art opening in Winona, and he was talking about how art is one of the few forms that you can use to ask questions that don't necessarily have an answer.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's really interesting. Do you have any certain people who you study when you're working, or other artists, or
you know, as content resource, subjective resource material, it's not as much other artists. I just don't look at other artists because that's their job to look at their own work, not my job to look at theirs. And if they want to look at mine, I'm more than happy to talk to them about it. But I keep going back to the obsessions of people. What are people obsessed with that drives their passion for the short span of time that they have on this planet, considering how much they really throw themselves into the things that they're really truly obsessed with, and how that becomes a creative act in their own right, and how that creative act talks about who we are, what we are as a creature, what we are as a sentient creature that is here for what reason, I don't know, but hey, let's keep exploring. And it's the exploration of these obsessions that and these hobbies, these bagatelles that drive me more than anything. I was up at Gold Rush Days to basically get a bunch of raw material. And boy, I tell you what, that is a resource untapped for some people as far as like really paying attention to who we are by that gray zone of the difference between, you know, a new object and junk. You have the flea market, you have the garage sale. And you look at these objects, it really tells us a lot about what kind of creatures we are by what we obsess with and what we accumulate. And then at that apex of that accumulation where we go, well, I don't need this stuff after all, do I? Because I can't take it with me. But yet we still accumulate and then we don't get to keep it, do we?
So I guess you study life more than you just study this institution of the art world.
Yeah, it's a sociological study of the human animal, really. Really is.
Would you say your work's a reflection of that animal or just...
One aspect, yeah. One aspect is my observations that take a three-dimensional form.
Yeah. Okay. If someone wanted to pursue a career that you have, kind of owning your own studio or running your own life, basically, what kind of advice would you give?
Keep your head down and keep plowing. Don't get distracted. Be ready to work as hard as a farmer, if not harder. Unless you have some kind of private funding. But I'm going to assume most people don't nowadays. That's kind of dried up, hasn't it? So, yeah. It's a matter of how stubborn can you be to the point of being your own obsessive winner at what you're doing, you know?
Do you show your work a lot?
Yeah. Yeah, I got shows stacked up, and it's a good feeling, too. I like to be able to say no. Just recently, I said no to the Walker. We were going to do an installation in their freight elevator, And I should back up. I didn't necessarily say no. We put it on hold because I couldn't fit it into my schedule. It's not that they didn't want it. And that's a good feeling to have.
Right.
So.
Do you do solo shows normally or installations or group shows?
It's a mix. A lot more solos, a lot more installations now. I'm not against a group show. There's two other artists that I really respect that I know. One's Sam Spixa out of Sartell. He's a metal fabricator. Fantastic craftsman. And Margaret Walramana out of Minneapolis, who's a prolific and insane detail-oriented painter of still life materials. And we have this setup show that we're pitching around because we all have some sort of connection to the natural world and a work that really complements each other in this trifecta show. So that's one we're pushing right now.
Okay. So you would want to show with them?
Oh yeah, if I was to show, if I had my choice, that'd be the first place to go. Totally respect their work, love their work. And we get along great too, so it's a heck of a lot easier showing the people that you actually can have a drink with.
Right, definitely.
Yeah.
Well, tell me a little bit about how your upbringing in kind of the more rural environment, how did that help you formulate your vision? I don't know if I want to use that word, but.
Here's how it's shaped me as the artist I am today. It has, and this is in retrospect, of course, because you don't know how this is happening when it's unfolding. It's all in retrospect. Looking back, I think that as growing up full on rural, I mean like farm kid, the whole business, and doing all the things that are traditionally a part of that lifestyle, in my opinion, that's helped me have a better work ethic, for starters. Have a lot more care and concern for the details of life because you have to make sure that, you know, when you grow up on a farm, you can't just do things sloppily. People could get hurt. You know, you're dealing with farm equipment, you're dealing with live animals, you're dealing with nature, you're dealing with the weather, you're dealing with so many aspects that, you know, have a danger factor to them at different levels. It makes you have a lot more respect for what you don't have control for or control of, and you don't have a lot of, you may not have a lot of input into, but you just have to accept, you know. 3 feet of snow? Well, wait till it's done. After it's done, well, start shoveling. Complaining ain't gonna make it stop. But you still gotta do chores. See?
Mm-hmm.
That's life. You can't just put it off because the animals need to be fed, the cows need to be milked, you know. You gotta put wood on the fire, you know, we can keep going on. And that's a part where it's just like, just accept it. It's okay.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. The series of windows I've done, they're all homages to country boys in pop culture. See?
Okay.
He was son of a moisture farmer,
totally
Luke Skywalker.
Right.
Superman was on a grain farm in Kansas.
That's so interesting.
King Kong is a country boy. Grew up in the jungle.
Right.
Yeah,
huh.
See?
Cool. I like that a lot.
Pa Ingalls from Little House on the Prairie. That's pretty much an easy mark. And they're all from that point in my life where I started getting into hobby when I was 13, 14 years old. And these were my pop culture icons. I didn't realize they were country boys at the time, but when I look back, I was just like, wow, that's that whole, like, you know, end of innocence. When you start really learning about what's going on in the world, not what it's about, but what is going on, you know, you lose a certain aspect of that child that we're always trying to reclaim in the fun things that we do.
Cool.
So far, I'm trying to hang on to it just enough so it keeps coming back into the work. And the pinball, too, that's the other thing. It's just the thing about the pinball and the bagatelles, the pinball is important because that's a great metaphor for life as far as I'm concerned, because there's an art aspect of it and a craft aspect of it that meet together. It's perfect to the hobby industry, maybe because it's a game, but also it's a great metaphor for life because it represents this choreography between skill and chance, or order and entropy. Where do you have control and where do you not, and how does that work together? And what are you willing to accept? Are you going to accept your score because you did your best? Or are you going to get really pissed off because it should have never been like that because I tried as best as I could? All depends on what baggage you bring to the game, isn't it?
Pinball's a metaphor for life.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe going back a little to your process, I don't know, what's your process when you're starting a piece or finishing a piece? Like, how do you go about conceptualizing something and mm-hmm. making it happen? What's your process?
I'd say the primary method that I use now is grabbing stuff and things, putting it in a pile, and just start running my fingers through it, throwing it around, looking at it, putting pieces together, and then there's this mental collage that starts to come together. Something gels. Once you have an idea that, you know, yeah, I'm going to make it about this, or this is something I want to discuss, or this is something I want to look at, I'm curious about that, I start grabbing the pieces, putting them together, something starts to grow in a collage fashion, physically and mentally, and then the editing process kicks in. There's this push me pull you, there's this back and forth between accumulation and omission, and you omit the things that you definitely know aren't going to help the editing process, but then you hang on to the things that may help, and you really keep close to the things that are, yes, definitely I'm going to use that, you know, I need this, I need that, put that together, they'll start building on that. So it's all accumulation with, you know, content omission, content editing.
So it's definitely not, you see it and you make exactly what happens. It kind of grows.
Yeah, absolutely.
As you're working.
Yep. And like I said before, you have to allow the things that don't want to be made or don't want to happen. If you can't push the materials in the right direction, or if things aren't going to come together, if they're not working, you got to allow that sometimes. You got to know when to stop pushing something. You have to know when to stop decorating things before it gets out of hand to the point where decorating it isn't going to make it any better anymore.
You mentioned earlier a little bit about the constant critique of craft versus art, if mm-hmm. there even is a definition for either.
Mm-hmm.
How would you describe that fine line and where you stand in your work process?
I have a set definition of where I stand in between the two, because I look at art, fine art, and craft, fine craft. They're amorphous gray areas that overlap at times, often. They exist in their own rights. And somewhere in that gray area where they meet, whether they overlap or get just close enough to each other, there's that. That's where hobby lies. That's where this obsessive person continues to ply their trade for that audience of one, because they're doing a creative process that has no other function other than to please themselves. You know, for lack of a term, it's very masturbatory. But they, at the same time, as they're so obsessive with the details and the perfection of execution, that they become a high craftsman or craftsperson as well. And both of those things exist in harmony at the closest point in hobby, in like really full-on hobby. And that's where I like to really row my boat. That's where I like to go down over the falls. That's where I really like to go swimming, is in that place, to find out how close can I get these two to mash together so they coexist, yet they don't exist. You know, so it stays in flux at the same time. Yeah, it's fine art. You know, well, it's stained glass. Yeah, but it's not stained glass that's functional, is it? It's not stained glass. It's more like a collage portrait or a collage painting, because you can't see through it. It can't necessarily be hung in a window. It's too dark. But if it's backlit, then it has these really rich colors, you know, things of that nature. How do I keep challenging the viewer to say it's this? And then the next viewer walks up and says, no, it's this. You know, how do you describe an elephant to a blind man?
Your phrase, an audience of one, it's pretty interesting. Do you like to work like that, as if it was an audience for one, or do you just like to keep that in your head when you're...
That's a starting point for me. If it doesn't please me as a piece that I'm working on, then it's not going to please anyone as far as I'm concerned. Hundreds may love it, want to pay millions for it, doesn't matter. If I don't like it, I can't be invested into it as much as I should. I need to be invested in the piece to where I throw myself into it with that same sort of hobbyist passion.
Do you think that more people should work like that? Do you think some artists kind of play off of the mass instead of the other way around? Because I know there's always that struggle.
I tell you what, more people could benefit from understanding the, you know, it may be utopian, but a lot of people could benefit from putting themselves more into their work rather than making the stale cookie cutter extruded business that some people call art nowadays. A lot of art that I keep seeing out there is absolute crap. It's not well made. There's not a lot of craft work into it. I was at the Victoria and Albert Museum in London a year and a half ago. What an experience. My gosh, the artisans that would just make locks, like padlocks, in the guilds. A journeyman, which was probably an apprentice who was probably less than 15 years old, could make this intricate padlock that had moving parts in the front that you had to work with before you could even get at the key. to insert it into the keyhole to unlock the lock. Incredible detail. And I look at something that's made like that, without all this technology distraction we have nowadays, just with that handwork, just the craftsmanship of it. And it becomes this piece that is never going to be used again because it's stuck in a museum because of the subjective weight it carries as a piece in history. How important it was to make something that good. And that was made by a kid. And I look at that and I go, gosh, that's a watermark for a lot of adult artists I know. My gosh. I got this term that when people whine to me, it's like, oh, I can't show. Nobody wants that. And I go, step up, buttercup. Quit crying and keep working harder. You know, up your standards. Raise your bar. If you're whining that nobody likes your work, then work harder and work more.
What do you think, if you had to create kind of a definition for an artist today, what do you think their role would be in society as a whole? Like what maybe your role or a general role should be?
Well, that's two different questions. I guess as my role as an artist, it is to create a lot of works of wonder. There has to be, we have to have these people in our society, in a clan, in a tribe, in a family, in a society. We have to have somebody, some person, some entity that is a creator of things of wonder that makes us be glad. This is what it means to be us. This is what it means to be alive. This is what it means to be self-aware of our place, as brief as it is in this continuum. Wow, look what we can do. Wow. Now, as a group of artists together, that may not necessarily be the apt description of what artists as a whole should be. I think it should be, you know, even more so than that as a group. We're dealing with a bunch of individualistic gurus here when you say artists. Everybody's got their own ideas. Everybody's got their own statement to make. Everyone has their own, you know, personal story to tell. Great, good. But when those personalities get together, I don't know if it could be made into a great, wondrous stew. I think there have to be some kind of understanding that artists come together and there's this wonderful energy, but at the same time, if it lasts too long, then they have to get apart. It's like, all right, I can only stand you for so long, I gotta go. And I think that's normal. I think it's okay.
You've done installations as well as small pieces. Do you have a preference of, like, scale-wise, how you work?
I like to work small because that lends itself more towards hobby, because you're obsessing in your own brain and you focus down tight onto something. And if you can do this tight, detailed work, so often people want to make things bigger, faster, stronger, more monstrous. And that's fine. That's great. Because I'm doing large murals and whatnot with the glass now. But I think I'm most happy when I can get lost in myself and just go into the zen of just making little things that kind of taps into that my obsession with obsession. And that you just fall into your own work doing that. You know, you get lost in this own tiny little world that makes you feel good. I'm doing everything right now that I should be. I'm doing everything now that I should be. I'm doing everything now that I should be. And it becomes a little zen move.
Is there anything else you want to add about yourself or your work or anything in general?
I know this won't get aired, but I really, really like bourbon. I'm a bourbon snob, so if anybody ever runs across a bourbon I haven't had a sip of yet, they need to tell me.
Connoisseur?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right, well, thank you for interviewing with us today.
Sure, sure, yeah. It's cool.
Thank you to Carl Unisch for joining us today on ArtBeat.
ArtBeat is written and produced by KQAL-FM on the campus of Winona State University. Visit us on the web at kqal.org.
If you are a local artist and you wish to be featured on ArtBeat, please give us a call at 507-457-5163 or email artbeat@kqal.org. This has been a part of KQAL Original Broadcasting.